Welcome to Shotgun Story, the podcast that has conversations with indie creators about music, meaning, and the point of it all, so that you may be inspired by the journeys of other artists who are doing it for themselves, and maybe gain a little more understanding as to why it matters quite so much that you keep creating. Danny DeVette is full-time drummer and one-time drummer for Avoid, Petit Cheval, Electric Petals, and Vonnebohm, and he's in studio with me. He's also an author, actually, which is one of the reasons that he's here, because he's written a book.
And it's not just any book, it's 648 damn pages long. Hello.
Like, properly, reading is an obsession for me, and I have yet to get to the end of it.
Okay, well, I'll fill you in.
What is really exciting, actually, on a side note, before we even begin, is that the book has also been made into an audiobook.
That's correct, yes.
Which is how we met.
Exactly, yeah.
But we'll get to all of that.
Okay.
I'm going to start at the very beginning. What does music mean to you?
Listening to music means a whole lot more than playing music to me. And I've got two answers on the playing, and the flippant one on the playing is people say, why do you play drums? And what I'll say, well, you know what a drum kit is to me? It's wood and metal that's a tool to get me laid.
Okay. I love the honesty.
But without being a spoiler, the book ends with a little section called Small and Precious and Bigger Than Rock and Roll. So playing music is... I feel blessed every time I play, okay? And I sort of said in the book that I was at a one of these kind of ring-ting courses, and you had to describe the most amazing moment of your life. And mine was not unexpected, I think, because playing music is uber special, and I always feel blessed, okay? So I'm going to read from that the last chapter of the book, okay? Yeah. It comes from a section called Small and Precious and Bigger Than Rock and Roll. A memorable task we were given at a life enrichment course was to describe the single most blissful moment in one's life experience thus far. And many of those present were surprised at my answer. The feeling of being surrounded by a musical brotherhood in full flight while applying the artistic gifts collectively bestowed upon the group in the manifestation of a song you have all created together on a stage in front of thousands of people who roar with approval as they acknowledge and celebrate a familiar piece of music that has special meaning to them is indescribable. It pales, however, next to something simple and deep that occurred on a morning after one of those exact occasions. I lay on my side, facing the window, the winter sunbeam streaming lightly onto my face, and I opened my eyes to a familiar throbbing hangover headache. My mind raced through the roller coaster blur of exciting freeze frames, and as I basked in the highlights of the previous night's Vonnebohm concert, a cliche came to mind. Life doesn't get better than this. Then it did. There was a slight rustle under the duvet behind me, and for the very first time, I felt my little son's arm wrap its way tenderly around my neck and give me a hug. Tears of joy gently flowed down my face and rolled slowly over the biggest Danny DeVette smile ever.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Okay, so that's playing music. Yeah. Listening to music, well, when I was young, I used to lie on the bed, listen to John Armour Trading, and wish for a broken heart.
That feeling of being particularly a teenager in those hard years, and to want to feel the feelings you're feeling and to have a reason to feel that way.
Yes, yeah. Well, I must also qualify that. So I wished for a broken heart. That's the ha-ha. I tell that story on stage, you know. But then it was more like this, like, true love, and you parted, but you are going to get back together again. These sad love songs are a phase to reuniting with that person, because it's the most glorious love ever, and it's forever. And so that was my positive exaggerian, because I'm not a Sagittarian. No Sagittarian's a Sagittarian. The exaggerian take on it, you know.
Who encouraged you to write the book? What made you do it?
I've been telling these stories over and over. When I had people at the club, People would come into the office and I would tell them stories about bands. And a lot of them are, it's like true love, stranger than fiction.
Yeah.
And I love it. So I would, and I love to tell stories, you know. And yeah, so I started writing a bit and then I kind of half did it. I had a big cancer op and I dodged the bullet. So they took out a 7.5 centimeter melanoma.
Wow.
And I didn't, it was encapsulated in a gland. I never even needed chemo. So I'm not grateful, but I always feel like I'm not grateful enough. But and then when COVID hit, I just thought, okay, well, I started this. Let me just knuckle down and do it. So it took me 2.5 years in COVID, you know. But I had written quite a lot of it before, a fair portion, which I had to then edit and change. And we took out, it would have been 1,000 pages. So, yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Have you always loved to write?
Well, you know, I got the job at David Gresham Records as in the marketing department because I used to write press releases for Wings Beat Bar, which I was a co-owner there.
Yeah.
So I was there at Wings. After Wings, we were signed to David Gresham Records, Vonderboom. And I was also doing other stuff. Like I was producing an Afrikaans artist called Fanny Oosthuizen. And we were at Sun City with Vonderboom and Mambo Number 5 was outside. And I was doing it in Afrikaans, just being too much tequila, going Klein Bicky Linda Diskinda, and I was finding like words Klein Bicky Karen for Erfaren.
Yeah.
And then Martin said, you should go record that, find an Afrikaans artist. So I did. And when I was in there, the marketing he was the marketing manager, was having an affair with the young Afrikaans virgin who was saving herself for her husband.
Yeah.
So they were never in the building, and I was in the studio, and David came in going, I need a press release for the Stereophonics, and he couldn't find the relevant people.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I'll write one, and if you don't like it, just throw it in the thing. He said, oh, you know? So I wrote it.
Mm.
And yeah, he's just then they offered me a job, and then the other guy left, and I took it over. So I was the one, and I had Roadrunner, and I'm the guy responsible for Nickelback, indirectly.
Yeah.
I heard that album, and I heard that song, Hey, How Are You? I'm not a Nickelback fan. I love this new documentary on Netflix. If you haven't seen it, go and watch it. It's really, really, really good. But for years, you know, Nickelback were people that were the band to hate.
Uh-huh.
So, but I remember hearing the How You Remind Me, because I'd put on all the Roadrunner releases. We would never press an album. It was all Sepultura, Slipknot, Machine Head. And so I'd put the medal on and I'd be replying to mails, and How You Remind Me came on, and then the phone went and I went back and I listened again. And my colleague who's running the dance department was like, who was that? Like, so the song is that immediately, you know, it's a hit. And I went, played it for David, and he agreed. I said, David, we've got a Brack Band, we've got a Credence.
Mm.
He said, what do you mean you've got a Credence, Danny? I said, we've got a Credence hit here. From Brack Band to Santon, people play Credence at their bras. This is that song. So I ended up working there. So, and then writing. So from there, it was just mainly like press releases and stuff. And then I started writing little articles and like pseudonyms and that's for fun.
Yeah.
Even writing my own like cool review.
Yes.
And then, but not only for me. I did do that for one of them, but I'd write one for an album that I'm promoting in my job. And then I ended up being interviewed for the SA Drums and Percussion magazine. And it had a huge distribution, not because of the interest of drummers. The guy that had it, he did something that went to everybody's, some other kind of publication that went to everybody's houses. And so when they printed, and he was a drummer and his son was a drummer. So they just did this and they printed up a whole lot and gave it to all the stores and whatever. And anyway, so they said they want to feature me.
Yeah.
So I remember, do you remember a band called Cheap Trick?
Yes.
I want you to want me, whatever, okay. So Rick Nielsen, there's two good-looking guys in the band and two nerds, Bunny Carlos, the drummer, always wore bow tie. And Rick Nielsen used to wear, like, caps, and he wore a jersey, and he said he always wore a jersey, so he'd sweat in the first song, so he looked cool for photos. And they featured him in the Guitar Player magazine. And Guitar Player magazine, way back in the day, before you had a lot of public, was a revered, and it still is, magazine, you know, for, like, Aldi Meola and all these phenomenal guitar players, Jeff Beck and whatever. And he was on the cover, and he said, they asked him, what made you be the guitarist you are? And he said, Robin Zander's such a crap player that I had to do something. And then he got a whole lot of people writing in to say, they hated it, and a whole lot of people who loved it. Mm. So, you know, so I thought, okay, I want to go that route. So I was just totally controversial in my thing. And they were saying, like, Dave Weckl, this like technical drummer. I said, oh God, he looks like my uncle who's going to the bathroom in the morning. He's got that image. Mm. Doesn't his music do anything for you? Yes, it makes my stomach turn. So I need to go to the loo because he plays such crap jazz fusion and all this kind of thing. And then I got an article, my own article, in the magazine. Mm. So I had a page called Bad Advice by Danny DeVette. So, yeah, and then I told stories in that. And then that's kind of the sum total of my writing.
Amazing. But now the book is full of stories, right? And yeah. Now you just mentioned being a bit controversial. And earlier you told the story about somebody who was having an affair at David Gresham's offices.
Yeah.
And I wonder, since you've released the book, has there been any backlash?
Oh, yes. My girlfriend, Karen Clark, and I don't mind if you say her name, blocked me because she didn't come to my birthday, and I put in the book that I'd muffed I'd do, and I sang happy birthday to her a few months earlier, and that wasn't fun. Fair. So, yeah, there's your controversy.
Oh, my goodness. Was she your girlfriend still when the book was released? Or
no,
was
it had happened. You know?
Earlier.
Yeah,
okay.
She just didn't come to my birthday, and you know what? Karma's a bitch. Yeah.
You mentioned that somebody said to you the other day, did you lie in the book?
My cousin went, did you lie? And I said, no. But what I did do is, and not often, is I would put two scenes that happened kind of back to back at a gig. And they'd happen on separate nights. But to set the whole thing up twice, it's more just like a technical thing.
Yeah. So everything is true.
I promise, yes.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Well, it's my take on it. You know, there's always this thing of how you remember stuff because – some people, you know, I mean, even people, I mean, Nibs van der Spey is my son's godfather. Yeah. You know, Nibs. And yeah, Nibs is so pure. I look into his eyes and I feel guilty for every rock and roll thing I've done. But he would, he says, Danny's got a memory like an elephant. He'll tell your band stuff you did that you all don't remember till he tells you. And that is true.
Yeah.
But often when I've told something and someone is convinced that it didn't happen like that.
Mm.
And it's not even like we're fighting about the outcome.
No.
Like I'll say something and Martin would say a different one, you know. It wasn't like that, you know. Yeah. I'm like, no, I distinctly remember that. And he says, I distinctly remember. And we were both in the same situation. So there is that to it, the subjectivity of it.
Absolutely. You know? I mean, they say there's my side, your side, and the truth.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, 100%.
Except if you're an exaggerator, then there's only one side.
Now, you lived through the golden age of live music in South Africa.
I was famous three times. Only in South Africa that can happen with all the bands. In the 80s, it was easy.
Yeah.
Actually, if you were, we had three TV stations, seven bands that had record deals. And if you had your videos on those three TV stations, you were famous.
Yeah.
It's just easy. It just happened like that.
Because we chatted briefly about it before we pressed record. We're talking about the state of support of live music in South Africa now.
Oh, yeah, it's dismal, hey?
It's dismal. It's very hard to make a living now.
Yeah. My friend Duck Charles knows how to do it.
Yeah.
And the Barnyards put on these like great shows, and they still fully booked up.
Mm.
So that's what happens as well. When there's little to do, then the ones that are good and surviving, they actually busier than other places. But generally, and for original music, I wanted to ask you, all the festivals that you play, like Misty Waters and Millie Pop and all that kind of thing, do the people make money there? Do the artists get paid well? Or
I can't really speak for anybody else.
Yeah.
I think generally with festivals, you play them for exposure and for because you love the people who run them and the vibe is good and it's where you you discover other artists and connect and network. I think,
but that's not an industry. That's a social game.
Exactly. Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, we all get paid.
Yes.
But I think, and I could be wrong, and I would need to speak to someone to get the facts on this, but I think that the bulk of the budget goes to the big draw cards.
Yes, but that's fair. That is fair. Okay, so if they're getting paid, then there's an industry.
I think so.
No, no. I mean, I'll tell you something that's not in the book. Rafael Dominic, the Polytones manager, I worked there for 6 years. Have you heard of the Polytones?
I did their PR, then I did my job.
Sorry. So I was. He owned the company Sovereign, and he basically, as I wrote in the book, his business acumen and Khan's talent took a normal West End band from the garage to the dome, selling out the dome. And but Raf got it so right that you see some of the radio stations for like Joburg Day or Jacaranda Day or whatever, they don't really pay the artists that much because it's a quid pro quo. They're playing your song on the radio and they'll still pay fair, but not what the band can command in another situation. And Raf turned that right around, that he had those radio stations begging him to for the Polytones. He'd say, nah, I want to play it.
Yeah.
he got it to that point. He'd say, because when I've played that, all the other shows that I would be playing in Gauteng over that month, I'm not going to pull the crowds that I would.
Yeah.
And I'll make three times in one show what you're paying me for that afternoon. It's not a business. It's not ideal for me business. And Raf got it to the point with the one radio station where he got a contract drawn up about how many times they would play the song, and he got a whole lot more out of it to accept double the fee than any other band got. So that's good business. That's really good. I admired him for that. He was very shrewd, and you know.
I mean, I remember Opie Kopi had a contract as an artist that you wouldn't be allowed to play any venues within a certain radius.
We had the same even with Splashy Finn in the day. Because you're coming there anyway, and now the festival's paying you a whole lot of money as a headliner, and now you're going to just dilute it to all those people who with on the fence about going to the festival.
It makes complete sense.
Yeah.
Especially for the big artists. For the small artists, it doesn't really matter. Because people are not coming to see you, but if they see you, well, that's a bonus. You know?
Reminded me of a story that I haven't told for a long time. It's not in the book at all, and I'll try also make it quick. Petit Cheval were on a tour, and then we were on our way to Durban. We were playing PE that night with a whole lot of bands, and these promoters wanted us they were going to fly us from PE to this thing. We played early. We were the first band up, and then we flew back to play that night in PE. So we played Durban and PE. But when we got to Durban, the flight was delayed. It was a private jet, a little aeroplane, not a jet, a little prop plane, but it was our plane, you know?
Yeah.
And they hadn't, all the money hadn't gone through, and the pilot was like, well, I'm not taking off until this and that. Anyway, it panned out. We got there, and they were supposed to give us our balance of payment in cash. And then they kept saying, no, we don't have it, but we'll give you a check. And we were like, no, we're not going to play. The pilot said, I'm driving, flying. So we ended up, Steve Fatal was the stage manager, and I love Steve, and I've got fantastic stories about Steve, but he's not your ideal stage manager because there's too much of a Jamaican influence in there. So anyway, we get on stage, we've taken all the money at the door, and we sort of split it and put it all into our underwear, and we get on. At the end of the first song, I broke the bass drum vellum with a big tasset at the end, and they didn't. So Steve, where's the spare vellum? He's like, hey bro, I'm gonna have to. There was no cell phones yet. Hey bro. So we ended up playing one song, and we said we're coming through to our own concerts, and we flew there, got paid a whole lot of money to play one song, flew back, and then Janooka were playing later, and Bokki De Beer was the drummer, and I saw him a few months later, and I said, how was that Durban gig? Because they hadn't arrived, we'd left already, I didn't see him, but and he said, it was cool, man, but no one got paid because some bloody band took all the money. I was like, oh, really?
Oh, no.
So there's a story I should have put in the book, but I actually just thought of it now. Yeah.
And talking of backlash, maybe you're going to get some from that.
Yeah, they split. Yeah.
So a little bit more cerebral for a second.
Yeah.
Your philosophy, what is it, on the role of rhythm as a drummer for life and for music?
Okay. Well, first of all, your heart's a drum.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a song called The Greatest Drummer in the World, which means everybody wants to meet the greatest drummer in the world. Everyone wants to meet that special boy or girl, because we're all drummers.
Yeah.
Okay. So actually, while I'm on that song, it's quite cool because I say your heart beats, doesn't strum. So everyone's a drummer, baby. And there's a middle eight where I said, add your name to the list in the Hall of Fame of the percussionists. And then there's a rap section that goes, let me just quickly record it. It goes, There are lots like Charlie Watts, Buddy Rich, and Lars Ulrich, Ginger Baker, Roger Taylor, Keith Moon the Loon, yeah, and Larry Mullen Jr. So I list all the drummers and I get to ring at the end. Okay, so yeah, I do believe I can tell you two kind of little takes on this. When Luca was a baby, I used to, and he's teething and it's like really bad and he's crying and that. I used to rock him and I'd play grooves onto him. And if I hit, I like to vary it from like a triple feel to like a standard feel. And if I hit the right rhythm, you would just go all like lum and stop crying.
Yeah.
So if you just somehow can get that. So that's, it's like uber important, the rhythm, you know?
Yeah.
And then I have like a little story, which is a life-changing moment for me. Before Evoid, we were called Void and we were a prog rock band. And we then did the circuit. We're playing the hits of the day all the way around the country, Bulawayo, Cape Town, Durban, PE. And but we'd always incorporate our prog rock. So we were very progressive musicians and we were pushing ourselves. And we were teen in our teens. We were like 19, 18. We had a song called How Calm the Storm that Lucien wrote. And Eric, and I didn't really have much to do with the writing then. I was a drummer, you know. And it was 17 minutes long, and it had all these time changes, and it was very demanding. It had flutes and glockenspiels and acoustic guitars, and you know, it was, and then you'd pick up the electric, and we'd down. It was like a big Genesis opus, like Supper's Ready kind of thing. And anyway, so yeah, but then slowly, by the time I got to Evoid, I'd left the band. I came back for that tour when Wayne was arrested. But now Lucien, he let go of all of that, okay? And it was like play for the song simply, you know? And then so I had to learn a song called Quella Walk. And all it was it was the bass drum going, and there was no sticks involved, okay? So it was, and you just did a little shaker, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just the way that you walk, the way that you. So he's teaching it to me now for the tour. And I was like, and he's like, that's it for the whole song, from the first beat to the. Because I was still on this thing, hey, you got to educate everybody and show off all your chops and that. And we got to PE. So I did it and we did a few gigs. And in PE at the Feather Market Hall, no one had heard the song. It hadn't been recorded. So these people are hearing it in the moment. It's not been played on the radio. It's not been recorded. It subsequently was. And I saw the way everybody was embracing the song.
Yeah.
And that changed my whole thing. And to cut forward to when I was with Vonneberg and we would do these parking lots, we were signed to Authentic Ideas with Nancy Hiller, the Hillary sisters, and Nancy was heading it up. And so they had the Woodstock concerts, and then they had Woodstock warm-ups. And outside the Look and Listens, we'd play like a free show to thousands of people in the parking lot on a Saturday afternoon. And Tweek was there. They always had to play last, because once Tweek played, all the little girls were going for half the crowd disappeared. So it was like Sugar Drive, Cutting Jade, Vonneberg.
Wow.
And I'd watch these great bands with great drummers, younger drummers playing. And I would look at the kind of ladies in this between 30 and 40, and they'd be standing still, like everyone's going, and the bands were playing. And I would get on and I'd just get into the pockets.
Yeah.
And I'd see those same girls start swaying, and then I knew I'm doing my job right. So, you have to, I call it I've never said this in public, but it's called the River of Groove. And I said to my son, you just jump into it and you don't fight it. Once you find that, you jump in and you just have to go one little pedal. No, just find it and then go. And if you imagine that in your thing, so you applied that to pipe band drumming. So he would sit there with the solos and he would just drum. And he's just in his mind go, okay, the river of groove. I'm going to, as I say, okay, start. And you jump into that river and you just lay down that groove. And yeah, he was SA champ, went to Basel. and I think I was actually such a fucking competitive dad that when he was at Candyland, He can I tell you a quick anecdote leading into that? So he had a, I had a red mohawk, and if you look in the front of the book, there's instead of a foreword, I put quotes.
Mm.
And the first quote is, "Danny, why do you always take things too far, Sita Vonneberg?" Because I pranked Sita, and I apologize again. I can never apologize enough. I really gave Sita a hard time with pranks. And he's always like, "Why do you always have to take things too far?" And then the second quote is, "Dad, please don't be yourself. Look at the vet on the way to all the school functions." Because imagine, you're a teenager, your dad's got a red mohawk, and he's in your face, you know. So the one time he said, when he was at Candyland, the little preschool thing, and he said, "Dad, No dad's got hair like yours. You know, I've looked and this and that." And I said, okay, I showed him a red Indian calendar we had with the Mohawks, Mohican Indians.
Yeah.
And then I showed him a music book with the punks, and I explained to him the whole thing. A few weeks later, I go to fetch him, and the teacher's like, "Can I have a word with you about your son?" And I was like, "Yeah, he's done something wrong. He's being a rock and roll." I'm hoping he's done something wrong. So she said, "We were teaching the kids about the Wild West." He puts his hand up and he went, "My house is the Wild West." And she said, "Why, Luca?" He said, "Because my daddy's got a mohawk and my mommy drives like a cowboy."
Okay,
where were we at now? My head's all over the place.
We were talking about the River of Groove. I challenge you to write your next book on the subject.
Oh, but I already have a title for the next book. It's called Yes Like, and it's the stories that make these ones pale. It's a short little book.
Oh, my goodness. So after that,
that's a good, I'll take that up.
The philosophical.
The River of Groove. I could maybe I'd need help from other drummers to get their take, to make it interesting.
You know what you could do? Here's another idea.
Yeah.
You could come to Solid Gold Podcast and make your own podcast where you interview drummers, and then you can take that information and you can transcribe it.
And say that I thought of it. Yes, yeah. I'll definitely do that.
No. But you'd put them out in the podcast, interviews with drummers, and then you would take that information and you would compile it into a book.
Oh, that sounds like fun. Thanks for that.
Pleasure.
Yeah, here we go.
I'm really excited about that.
It'll
actually
be good. The River of Groove.
In fact, you could even call your podcast that.
Yeah, The River of Groove. Yeah. So free swimming lessons. I'll get a sponsor as well, you know.
Brilliant. You missed the Olympics though.
Yeah.
Next time. Okay, you've been on tour everywhere in South Africa. I know further than that, but I'm actually only interested in this for now.
Yeah.
Best place to tour, best reception of live music.
Well, the best, let me start with the best venue, I think, and maybe you've played there as well, is the Blue Moon in Nelspruit. I don't know if you ever played at that venue.
Yeah.
So if anyone said to me, "Danny, you can see Bob Dylan anywhere in the world and invite like 200 friends."
Mm.
That's amazing, because in that little amphitheater with the – and, you know, Anthony Bumstead's no longer with us.
Devastating. So. Yeah.
There's stories about Anthony in the book as well.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He's that would be the best thing. The best gig – I filled in for a band and at last minute – and the guy who was running the band, I had a kind of a love-hate thing with him, I'm not going to say who it was for a change.
Yeah.
Just last minute. I literally, on the afternoon, can you come? And I said, "Listen, I'm just going to play on the fly." It was all original music. So I just had to go. There's no ways I'm going to remember this and learn it all.
Yeah.
So I just did a Keith Moon, you know, like the bass player just played me a little bit of a boom, boom, boom. Okay. And I just went and I felt everything around me. And apparently this guitar player who led the band was very strict. They'd have to rehearse all the songs every time before they did anything new. And it was just no fun for anyone in the band. That came out all – I kind of half knew that. But anyways, they had this keyboard player, Canadian girl. She was a little bit ditzy, hippie-ish stuff. And afterwards, all these people are like, "Wow, that's the best we've ever seen your band." And they go, she's like, "Yeah, man, this is Danny. Do you mind like speaking to our drummer and everything?" And everyone's giving me all this love. And then he got all upset with it because it went against everything of his control and his thing. And people are going, "No, that's a," other fans just keep coming up and saying, "I've seen your band so many times. I've never seen you like this. This is what you need."
Yeah.
And he kind of put the blame on me. And he said, "Oh, Danny, you're always such a main guy stealing the limelight." Because I do on stage. That's Sita Osunas. When he's playing a mouth organ numbers, he's spraying my hair, look, trying to get the audience to look at me. So, but my thing is, step up to the plate. Be David Lee Roth. You can't be that. Then you don't deserve to be in a band with me. You got to outdo me. You're the singer, man. You got all the. Anyway, so. So he said, "Yeah, what's the biggest crowd you've ever played to?" And I was like, 117,000. But that's the only time I played to a crowd that size. Yeah. You know, the next one was like 50,000, you know, yeah. Half. But it was concert in the park. And that was what a feeling, eh, to play. You know, it was with Petit Cheval, and you see the banners in the – so, but it's quite surreal. You know, it's not playing-wise the best because it's kind of out there. It's like a dream, you know.
Mm.
But I went straight to the production office and said, how many people are here, you know. Yeah. But Gavin from Sogol, he disputes that figure because he's working on it. So there you go. It's who's truth, you know. But that's what they told me on the day.
So what is the smallest crowd you've ever played for?
A groupie of one in a bedroom. Okay.
I'm going to change that slightly. And smallest crowd you've ever played for in a venue.
In a venue.
Yeah.
Well, I've played to 20 people, yeah. You know. Yeah, yeah. And that's when the two test is, you know. Yeah. Like, but I'll tell you quite a cool little story. We were down in Cape Town, early days of Vonneboom. Because we joined two bands together when Simple Minds closed for us.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that's.
And after that, we had to go out and be a band, you know? So yeah. We were down in Cape Town and we're playing the Purple Turtle, but we partied so hard the night before that we all didn't make it back to our accommodation and ended up sleeping on some of us on a tiled floor, like in someone's townhouse, okay? And yes, we were all just like, oh, we got to get through this gig and drive back. We were on the roll of like 4 or 5 nights of no sleep, you know?
Yeah.
And it's one of the few times I didn't feel like playing. You know, it's just like I knew one of the cars was going to break down because this has started. And I was like, well, I doubt we're going to get back. And okay, and then the next minute we get on stage and we do this big opening, rah, and Martin comes over to me, and the Purple Turtle had a tattoo shop upstairs, okay? Yeah. But Martin comes up to me and he goes, "Where's Cedar?" And I said, "I thought he was with you." Anyway, we had to go off. So the crowd were all, hey, it was like pretty full, yeah. But like it wasn't packed, but it was pretty full. And like, yay, and then we just got off. And then we were like, where's Sailor Cedar? He'd fallen asleep on the carpeted stairs up by the tattoo parlor. So he just like lay down and we were so exhausted. So I said, okay, well, now we have to go back on. Okay, let's all take work, just go back on in our underpants. So we did that for fun, you see. Yeah. And now I felt like playing. Anyway, we're at the end of that that night, and yeah, just standing on top of the drums, taking the tom-toms off, throwing them into the crowd, just going crazy. And there's two guys leaning against the wall. And the one guy says to me, great gig, mate. You're a really entertaining drummer, you know. So I said, a British guy. I said, oh, thank you. Hi, I'm Danny. And as I shake his hand, he says, I'm Martin. And I looked at him and I said, Martin Chambers. It was a Pretenders drummer. So it shows you never know who's in the crowd.
100%.
You know? So I said, Martin Chambers. I said, guys, hey, we've got the Pretenders drummer here. Who's here? And he goes, that's nothing. And he points to the guy next to him. He says, this is Chris Thomas. So Chris Thomas worked on the Beatles, White Album. He did all the NXS. He did all the Pretenders. He did Roxy Music, Avalon. So Chris Thomas, if you go Google him, he's like an Uber producer, like an Uber producer. So... yeah, so anyway, so I said, what are you doing here, you know? And he went, well, Jim Kerr actually told us to come to Cape Town. We were thinking of going to Hawaii or Cape Town on holiday. And Jim Kerr said, it's a no-brainer. There's prettier girls in Cape Town. So isn't that nice to hear for our country?
That is nice. Yeah. I would concur, though.
Yeah, me too. And I've got proof.
You've got proof?
Of things like that in my own brain.
We're not going to discuss those kinds of things.
Okay.
So what does making music look like for you these days?
Okay, so I don't play drums anymore. Mm-hmm. I did a brief Petit Cheval thing there. I'm not as good as I was, and I kind of lost my passion for it.
Mm.
It was mainly when Lucas is so good.
Yeah.
So at the book launch at Emperor's, Luke and I played together. So I wanted Lucas to be able to play. Lucian flew out from London. So yeah. we played Evoid. So my son got to play with my friend for 50 years and the Evoid songs. He then backed No Friends of Harry, who also came, and Tim Parr also played. And then we had the Vonneboom. So the two of us were playing the Vonneboom songs. and Paul from the Partisans also came. So I had like my whole career, all these people came, and that was a great night with us, the two of us playing drums, you know.
Oh, wonderful.
But what I do now is I do unplugged storytellers, and I always have like a good guitar player. I have a guy called Damien Kruger, who I play with mostly. I've walked a long road with him. And I've just done one with Miel Vinniting. Vinniting, how do you say it? Miel Gielmiel.
Oh, Miel Vinniting.
Vinniting, yeah. I said she must change her name because even she can't pronounce it. So she's fantastic. So I just did a gig with her. Down in the Eastern Cape, I use Kerry Hiles.
Yeah.
And then I always have a good singer with me as well. Because okay. I'm okay. I'm a good entertainer, but I need a good guitar player and a good voice to make the show the quality and the standard that I want. And I tell stories. So, for example, I'll say when my sister was 19, she married an armed robber when he got out of jail. And people's jaws dropped. Like, huh? And I go, it's true. It was the best thing that could ever happen to me because I went to my mom and I said, Mom, I want to join a band. I want to take recreationals, drink tequila, shag groupies, and sell my soul to Santa. And my mom went, that's fine, my boy, as long as you don't marry an armed robber. So that's the kind of thing. And then my mom would say, I tell a little story about standing naked in front of the mirror singing Sympathy for the Devil. I was obsessed with the Rolling Stones. I had a little portable record player. I'd take it into the bathroom. And my mom would be like, what's going on in there? I'm like, Mom, I'm naked. I'm singing to Sympathy for the Devil. She goes, I want you to stop singing Sympathy for the Devil in the bath, and I want you to stop listening to everything Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, and I want you to stop obsessing about the Rolling Stones. There's only one way I could answer. Mom, you can't always get what you want. And then we go into the song. So that's kind of the live show.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, so for anybody who's keen to check you out, you're active.
Yeah, I do. I'm going all over. I'm going again in November to the Eastern Cape. I'm going to Durban in October and possibly Cape Town straight after that and then back here.
Okay, amazing.
So I don't play all the time, so it's quite nice because it creates a bit of a demand and then people know that they must come now because you can't just see me next week, you know?
And so if someone wanted to follow you on social media and find out
Facebook.
More. Facebook.
Danny DeVecchio. I do everything through there. Sell books, gigs, everything.
Okay, amazing. That's fantastic. Final question. Favorite South African band right now?
Matthew Mole.
Okay.
I saw him at Splashy.
Yeah.
He owned it again, eh?
Yeah.
So I met him when he came up. He Just Music had a showcase gig with Nakane Touré and him on the same night.
Yeah.
And the Anti-Retro Vinyls were also going to play that night, but then they ended up, one of them was, something happened, either accident or car accident or something. Mm. And anyway, so they played. His next gig was opening for Polytones. And Matthew, it is his stage persona where all the girls want to kind of love him and bang him at the same time. You know, it's that kind of weird thing, mother him. And he was all up because he's like, oh, I'm from Cape Town. This is a bit, you know. And he said to me, are you nervous? You say, like, I'm fully nervous. So we're going to go out now and do this. And so I said, okay, let me tell you a joke to calm you down. And I said, what's the difference between a Ferrari and a dead hooker? And he went, I don't know. And I said, I don't have a Ferrari in my garage. So every time he sees me, he goes, you bought that Ferrari yet? So, yeah.
Wonderful. He's a good guy.
Yeah, and talented. Super talented.
And talented.
Yeah. My favorite South African band, I'd have to say.
Are you going to say one of them?
No, not at all. Not at all. No, never say Ben Armin. No. It's not about. I love Vulnerable. I mean, you know that I do. I was there for 13 years.
Yeah.
And we've kept on. I mean, we still. We're at the book launch. I mean, yeah. So I don't see a lot of gigs, but like they've all had 50th birthday parties now.
Yes.
All three of them actually. Yeah. Because you must understand, I was way older. Hey?
Okay.
I was like in my 40s. They were in their 20s.
Oh.
So God gave me a second. It's good we mentioned this.
Yeah.
God gave me a second. My midlife crisis was a second teenage life.
Amazing.
So that's why I've never grown up. So Luca's more mature and responsible than I am.
Yeah.
So that's cool. Kind of, it's a little bit opposite, but it works. And so my favorite South African band ever is the Radio Rats.
Okay.
Jonathan Handley is a genius, absolute genius for me.
I'm very looking forward to finishing your book. And okay. I'm very excited for anybody who is thinking about reading it or listening to it when the audiobook
comes. It's going to be out pretty soon.
Okay, yeah, amazing. Yeah. Thank you for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. Okay. Thank you, Tori. And now I'm a bit too rock and roll for you.
You are delightfully rock and roll. Thank you.
Is it? Okay. Yeah, I hope it wasn't too. Okay.
It definitely wasn't.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Yay. If you are an independent artist whose passion for what you do can inspire or fuel others, get in touch. I'd love to chat. You can find me on shotguntory.com.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.
Found sequel will forever disown the riffs that have brought us all down and alone. And the best of the wounds cruelly etched on the tombstone. Combined with the death of engraving and the bitter part of spinning fool to think life will atone ignores the why to betray is degrading. Cause to lie to a heart that's filled with trust, you've got a sacred love. Did you find out why you were down there? And if you did, don't tell me, I don't wanna know. To funeral and be okay into broken when they put the fairy to a fair, they must have been joking. When they put the fairy to a fair, they must have been joking. If I don't laugh I'll cry, if I don't laugh I'll cry. Saddest song you'll ever hear.